So do you like spending a lot of time at the Visitor Center then? Eddie said you're up there almost every day.
I like to go by there at least once every day and say hello to the visitors. I hope you see from me is what you get. I'm just plain old Jimmy. I'm not anything special or anything. It's something that I enjoy doing, and I like to say hello and talk to all the visitors to see what they think about our products. You know, for many, many years, you would make the product, age it, bottle it, and sell it, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we do a lot of traveling, doing seminars and tastings. You get to meet the people that's drinking and see what they have to say about it. And that's what I enjoy so much about it, meeting the people and saying hello to them. Just like he's talking about, you go to Australia. There's some Australian visitors over there right now from Brisbane, Australia. We have visitors from all over the world comes here.
And you finally get to see that other side of the fence then, right?
I get to see the other side of the fence.
Outside of Lawrenceburg.
Outside of Lawrenceburg. I was born and raised here. I live within a mile where I was born and raised.
Everyone, I hope you enjoy this episode with one of the last living legends. It's a big checkmark for us. There's additional audio that you can only get by being a Patreon supporter, so make sure you support the show to make that happen. In addition, we did our Patreon giveaway this week. 4 lucky winners were shipped boxes of small batch bourbon truffles from Art Eatables, who we had back on episode 60. They're insanely delicious, so go do yourself a favor, go to their website and order a box. I guarantee it, you won't be disappointed. While on their site, you'll also see that there's the 12 Days of Bourbon going on right now, where they have 12 different bourbon truffles made from 12 limited releases this year, including a 2016 Four Roses Small Batch and even a Pappy Van Winkle 20-year. So thank you to Art Eatables for this awesome giveaway. There's a lot of effort that goes into producing the show. The emails, phone calls, Google Hangouts, recording, mixing, editing, publishing, and more. It all takes a lot of time. The sponsorships we get through Patreon is the real engine that keeps this going. If this wasn't a user or listener-supported podcast, Ryan and I probably would have stopped doing this a long time ago. So I just want to say thank you to everyone who supports the show, and we're slowly reaching the 100th episode mark. If you haven't supported the show yet, please visit patreon.com. That's patreon.com/bourbonpursuit to learn more about all the cool swag that you can get, such as t-shirts and koozies and everything like that. So I hope you sit around and enjoy this week's episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Bourbon Pursuit Podcast. Kenny and Ryan here again for our second installment here at Wild Turkey. So, Ryan, what do you think so far?
Well, the interview with Eddie was awesome. It was pretty raw and pretty cool. Wild Turkey's going to be in good hands with him, but I'm super excited about Jimmy. You know, who we're just talking, he says he's nobody special. That's bullshit. He's somebody pretty special, and I'm super excited we get to talk to him.
Yeah, I think this was, as we were kind of saying in the very beginning, very excited to have this. You know, Jimmy's a living legend, and we hope that, you know, we're capturing a lot of good things that are coming through here to be able to live on for more generations beyond him, to be able to listen and kind of get a lot of wise words, maybe some good jokes out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully some cool story, you know, some fun stories.
So with that, we'll introduce our guest. So today we have Jimmy Russell. Jimmy is the master distiller, former master distiller, current master distiller, whatever you want to say. He's a jack of all trades here at Wild Turkey.
Still working every day.
Yes. So Jimmy, again, thank you so much for taking time out and welcome to the show. I know you have a very busy travel schedule, so this is a real treat for us. But we always start and we want to talk about the history of the person behind the story. So kind of talk about, you know, your childhood, your upbringing, life before even Wild Turkey.
Well, I was brought up in a bourbon family. My dad worked at a bourbon distillery. Actually, he worked for the Old Joe Distilling Company here in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, back when I was growing up, which was an old distillery here.
Did you say Old Joe?
Old Joe.
Okay, gotcha.
And then in the later part of his years, he was working here at the Wild Turkey Distillery. So I've been brought up around the bourbon. In Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, it's a small community, and it was 4 distilleries in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky when I was growing up. And you had families working at all the bourbon distilleries, and it's just natural that you wanted to get into the bourbon business. You was brought up in it.
It's the only thing around.
So kind of talk about, you know, what happened to Old Joe at that point?
Well, Old Joe finally, they went out of business at the distillery. It's another company that owns that Old Joe brand now. That's still on the market. Another distillery here in Kentucky owns that brand label. It's been a lot of consolidations. the distilleries. When I started, it was approximately about 27 bourbon companies in Kentucky, about 50-some-odd bourbon distilleries in Kentucky at that time. There's all small distilleries. It's been consolidations over the years. All the brands are still out there, but they've been consolidating to other companies and bigger companies. And actually, we're the only one that actually say this. Everything here is still Wild Turkey products. We don't have any other products. It's all Wild Turkey products. Most of bourbon distilleries has a lot of different labels, a lot of different brands coming from all the other old distilleries around.
Gotcha. So talk a little bit more about your upbringing. So you're born into a bourbon family. Your dad worked at a distillery. What about other family members? Mom, uncles, anything like that?
Well, I had
grandfather.
Uncles and cousins and everybody working at distilleries back in that day and time when I was growing up. Say it was four distilleries here, and even today, most of us still have families working at all other distilleries. In the still bourbon business, we're all close friends, and we do anything we can to help each other out. And if anything goes wrong, and all of us has families working at all other distilleries. Still to this day, we got people here. Husband works here, his wife works for another distillery. We got a lady here, her husband works for another distillery. So it's family affair, I call it, in the bourbon business.
Was there anything before you got started in the bourbon industry that you wanted to do maybe different than the bourbon industry?
You know, really, the only thing I think, if you look back at my yearbook in school, I thought someday I might be a professional baseball player. I played sports.
What position?
I played shortstop and when I was playing sports.
Give Derek Jeter a run for his money.
That's what from a lot of the reading, you're kind of a regular old Jim Thorpe. I mean, you were baseball, basketball, track, all those different kinds of things.
I played all sports, football, basketball, baseball, and run track.
So was baseball your kind of your clutch? Like, you really think it was your favorite?
Well, you know, to me, still to this day, I still love sports. But I'm football if it's football season. I'm basketball if it's basketball season. And nowadays, you know, when I was growing up, they didn't run together like they do now. When you started school, football season was over with, you started basketball. Basketball was over with, you started baseball and track in the spring of the year. Now they all run together, but they were separate back then. You don't have that opportunity now maybe to play all of them because they all running together now. You've got basketball, football, everything going on right now.
All right, so what are Jimmy's teams? Who do you root for?
I'm a University of Kentucky Wildcat fan.
Yeah. There you go. You don't root for those dirty birds.
We'll take that. What about professional baseball, professional football, anything like that?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I was a big Boston Red Sox fan. Back then, in that day and time, there was only eight teams in each major league. We have so many of them now, but it was only eight teams. In Louisville, Kentucky, 50 miles down the road, was a AAA farm club for the Boston Red Sox. And my dad took us there a lot to baseball games. So when I was growing up, that's all I knew about was the Boston Red Sox. So back in that day and time, I was probably, now I enjoy it. Cincinnati's one of my favorite teams now because they're close by. In football and pro basketball.
A lot of disappointments.
they were the Bengals for a long time in football, and then they've come the Bongles.
That's
now
right.
They're back doing pretty well. They're doing better now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we'll kind of move on to your life now inside the distillery. So let's talk about what really made you come to Wild Turkey in the very beginning. Like, what was there just a job opening? Was it union work? Like, kind of talk about what made you want to move into the brown spirits business.
Well, say my family had always been in the brown bourbon business, but actually my wife was working here before I was. And
so you're chasing her around.
No, we were married.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And she put me to work. Joretta, my wife, I tell them she put me to work. But yes, that was the place I was looking for to come to work. Fortunate enough, I got on here in 1954. Been here ever since.
What was the first job you had?
Actually, they called it quality control back in that day in the distillery, learning the distillery part of it. But you'd go get your samples of grain and things. You'd run the test on. Before the day was over with, you might be down with a scoop shovel shoveling that grain out of the truck. You'd done a little bit of everything back in that day and time, where now everything's brought to the labs and to them and all. But we'd done just about everything back in that day and time. Anything to be done in a distillery, you done it.
What was the worst job you done?
I've never had a worse job. It's always always enjoyed what I've done.
Because he said it's not even a job, right?
That's right. That's right.
So kind of talk about some of the other roles that your family has taken in the bourbon industry. Like, what was your wife doing when she was here? And, you know, what was also your father doing?
Well, my father was head of maintenance. He always told a story that if he didn't make the pipes leak in the right place, I couldn't make good bourbon. And my wife was in the administration end in the office.
Okay. So what was really the state of Wild Turkey when you first joined?
Well, Wild Turkey was an up-growing bourbon at that time, and it's continued to grow and grow and grow. Actually, when I come here, we was making about 50 to 60 barrels of bourbon a day. We had about 40 to 50,000 barrels in storage. Now we're making 560 barrels a day, and we got over 600,000 in storage, so it's continued to grow. It's good for me. If we're still making 50 barrels a day, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I wouldn't have had a job. But the bourbon business right now is as strong as it's ever been.
So how big was the operation back then? I mean, how many stills, how many?
Same as it is. Our operation here has not changed one bit. We had a column still and a doubler, second distillation. Still the same thing today, except to say we was only making very little at that time. We go on bushels of grain mash per day. We was mashing about 1,200 bushels of grain a day. Now we're mashing over 4,000 bushels a day.
Well, you're not scooping them anymore either, right?
No, I'm not at the scoop.
So who taught you everything that you know today?
Mr. Bill Hughes. He was a young distiller before Prohibition. And he come back and put this distillery in operation after Prohibition. And he lived right up here on top of the hill. He lived right here close to the distillery. And he's one of those that, like I feel like I am, I want to do everything, you know. He done made his own yeast, and that's one thing we still do, make our own yeast every day here. We have our own yeast culture. But he taught me everything. Most of the things in our business, especially in the distilling end of it, chemistry, science, and engineering will help you. But it's so many things that I cannot prove to you scientifically. It's on-the-job training.
So I was going to say, what is just... with technology, what has changed in distilling over the years?
Well, when I started, everything was done by hand. You open and close the steam valve and the pumps going into the still by hand. You pull the lever to weigh the grain up, close the lever when you got the right amount. And nowadays, equipment's got so much better. It's controlled. For instead of doing it by hand, you're sending computers. We have a computer system now. They make computers that you can run this place from somewhere way off. But our computers, the way we got ours set up, we still have to have operators there. Instead of you sitting there opening and closed valves by hand, you can punch buttons when you get ready to weigh up your grains, or when you get ready to start cooking, you can punch buttons and start, and you have to still be there and be right out there with it. But that's the thing about it. And this is something you strive for, and you got to be consistent in the product you're making. If when you're running your still, you want the same proof all day. If the proof varies up and down, the flavors will be up and down. So with this, you know, we're human. You might be a little slow sometime opening and closing a steam valve or a pump valve. Where the computers will open and close them right now as it needs adjusting.
So it takes a combination of man and machine to kind of fine-tune it,
yes. Mm-hmm.
About what time do you think that really the computers and the automation pieces really started becoming a critical part of the process? Because, you know, you said that really the history behind it is a lot of handmade and a lot of I don't know, put the word artisanal on it, right? Whatever you want to kind of spin on it. But at what point did you say, okay, we need to embrace this. We need to start looking at making this more efficient.
Well, when the equipment started coming out, I say sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, they started coming out with some of the equipments that controlled better and all.
And were you fully embraced of it? Or was it a hard sell for you?
No,
you
said, it wasn't anything to improve your operations. You're better off, you know, be more consistent. That's what we strive for here with Wild Turkey. We want it to taste the same today, tomorrow, 6 months from now, or 8 years from now when you buy it. We want our product to be the same. We want it to taste. I don't want something to taste one thing. You buy a bottle of Wild Turkey today, you buy one 2 weeks from now, and it has a different taste, different flavor. I don't want that. I want it to be consistent. I want you to remember it's the same taste, same flavor that you did last time you had a drink of it.
see, in my business, they say you want to automate as much as possible so you can take more vacations.
No, not me.
So you consider yourself to be kind of old-fashioned when it comes to the bourbon process, because we're now living in a time where cask finishes are really starting to like pop up everywhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is something that I've seen happen in my years. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, bourbon was strong. In the middle 70s, you young people come along, start drinking that white stuff, gins and vodkas.
I don't know about 70s yet.
You're too young. But then bourbon kind of went down a little bit, and we didn't change anything here. A lot of the bourbon distilleries changed their formula, trying to compete with the lighter products. And even our federal government passed a law at that time that you could make light whiskey. It didn't go over. We didn't make any. And Eddie, my son, he would tell you, Daddy's hard-headed and old-fashioned. He don't change anything. He probably told you that. I don't know. And it's paid off for us. We stayed the same, and it's continued to grow for us and continued to grow. And now in the late 80s, bourbon has come strong worldwide. Anywhere in the world now you go, bourbon is strong. Overseas, our overseas business is huge right now. In the States, it's growing leaps and bounds. Say it's right now, it's the highest it's ever been in production and what's being sold of bourbon right now.
What was life like for you before the boom? A lot more peaceful?
Well, no, it's still the same. It's not any difference in it. You just have to make more. The biggest thing we have to plan on here, most of your bourbons on the market is 4 and 5 years old. We're planning from 7 to 12 years. So, you know, in y'all's business, if you was doing a program now that you're not going to show or have on the radio 7 years from now or 8 years from now, what it'd be. But that's what we've got to plan on all the time.
Yeah, I can't even predict 3 months. I can't even predict the next quarter.
That's what we got to plan on, you know, 7 to 12 years from now, what people's going to need.
So I want to kind of talk about some of the things that you've done here at the distillery. Like, what do you think are your golden stamps? Some of like the big high like scoreboard check marks that you've done here over the years, of maybe changes you've made or things that you've kept on and haven't changed because of maybe people said, maybe Campari said, you need to come in, you need to change this, and you said, no, I'm putting my foot down. Right?
No, I've been fortunate. Everybody that's owned us, they've always told me they didn't want to change Wild Turkey. They want to be made the same. I've even had the CEO of the company tell me that if they come inside to change this to save a little money, if I let them change it and it changed the taste of the product, I was fired. And that was the head man of the company telling me that. And they've always been fortunate. I've been fortunate. They've always let us to make it the way we want, like we've always made it. Distilling it low proof, put it in a barrel at low proof, using less corn, more rye, and barley malt in our formula. Making our own yeast every day, where a lot of people went to sack yeast now, buying yeast, but we still do it the same way as the day I come in here in 1954, except we got so much bigger.
So I kind of want to shift gears a little bit and talk about some of your old friends, right? Because you were best friends with some of the greatest minds in the industry, you know, really before bourbon was cool and before a lot of these brands were really starting to make it out there. So talk a little about your camaraderie between people like you and Elmer and Booker.
Well, Booker and Elmer and I, we're all real close friends. We're together all of us, you know, here in the bourbon country in the central part of Kentucky. We all live within an hour of each other. Even today, we see each other some 2 or 3 times every week going out to eat at nights or a place like that, you know, where he lives. But Booker and Elmer and I, we were the three old ones back, and we had great fun together. We enjoyed being with each other. And I was the first one, many years ago, nobody was out in the field was marketing salespeople. And this company about 25 or 30 years ago decided that I ought to go out in the field and talk to the consumers and talk to our marketing salespeople. And that's the first time that I don't know of that any people from actual making it was out in the field talking to consumers and their marketing salespeople, where it had always been marketing salespeople. And then Booker and Elmer started doing the same thing. And I think done a great job in promoting bourbon all over the world. And knowing, let people know what it's about. Because I know when I first went out, it was all whiskey. It didn't make any difference what it is. It's all whiskey. Nowadays, people are so well educated, and I'm not good on these computers and things like that. I didn't grow up with them. But nowadays, you know, You got the women's bourbon side of the world. You got the whiskey women of the world. Men's bourbon side is whiskey side. And they're on the internet. So they know everything's going on all the time. So people are better educated now on what they're getting and what they're buying. And this is something that's really improved our business, I think.
So talk about when all three of you would get together. Would you guys try each other's bourbons, kind of figure out, are there any secrets we can steal from one another?
No, that wasn't
the same. Booker forces hams on you? He aged.
Ham, bean biscuit and country ham.
That's right.
And butter bean soup.
That's right.
Yeah, Booker and Elmer. Booker was, I think I always said he was a little... the latest one, and maybe I was in the middle, and Elmer's sort of a quieter fella, but we all had a lot of fun together. We was together a lot and meeting, and we used to. We don't do as much now because the older bunch is gone. I'm the only one of the older bunch. It has become one of the oldest bunch now, 35 years of service. Him and Fred know Booker's son. Mm-hmm. They grew up together. They've known each other. Parker Beam in Heaven Hill, he's in bad shape now. His son Greg, all of them grew up together. If we was all together in the bourbon business, they've all grew up together, and they've been close friends all the time. So generation after generation is what I enjoy so much seeing about. But we'd get out together, you know, and we'd have a lot of fun.
Fishing trips? What kind of things you all do together?
I never was a fisherman. Booker was a fisherman. Elmer wasn't too much in fishing or anything. We were more just around communities and all like that. But
casual drinking buddies.
Casual. Now, we used to get together several years ago. We don't do this much now because we've got so many younger ones in. Once or twice, once every month or two, somebody, one of the masters said, come to our distillery certain night, certain time, bring your own bottle, but you can't drink it. And on the invitation, the last thing he said, the last and out, turn out the lights.
And now you're hanging out with Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey, he's one, to me, he's, when he's been here, he's down to earth just like one of us, the way I feel about him. He's been just as plain as he could be around here.
So going back, one last question about, you know, you and your tight-knit group of friends there. So kind of, you know, bourbon aside, like not really just bourbon, but kind of just talk about the traits and the characteristics that Booker and Elmer had that you really admired.
Well, Booker was one of these fellas, and I hope just like I am, Elmer was the same way. If they had a product, if they didn't like it, they'd tell you right up front. They wasn't going to beat around the bush about it. Booker shakes it. You know, we tell you the truth right up front. Don't get me wrong what I'm going to say here. It's so many marks and spills now that really, you know, it's marketing.
Hell yeah.
It's marketing. We was always down truthful of what we said and told people. And we believe if one of our products, we didn't like it, we tell you we didn't like it. But Eddie will tell you now when they're doing things, they'll bring it in for me to taste, and he said all he has to do is when I get ready to taste it, that he knows right then, well, just Wells forget about it. Or he said, he's told people that, well, Jimmy, taste that, it's all right, but I wouldn't buy it.
So what do you do that before you taste it, if Eddie's going to be like, we might as well just scrap this idea?
I don't say anything. That's left up to them. You know, we were the first ones to come out with a flavored bourbon. I don't know if y'all know this or not. Mm-hmm. Honey bourbons are just now hitting the market strong. We come out with ours in 1976. They asked me to come up with something. Ladies thought bourbon, unless it's from Kentucky, thought bourbon was too strong. And they wanted something with a good bourbon flavor or sweeter and all. So that's when we come up with the honey liqueur, which is our regular bourbon with honey and sweetener and flavors added to it. And it's a huge business for us now. And everybody's getting into that honey flavor. But we come out with it in 1976.
See, that's a scoreboard mark right there, right? You say that's part of the Jimmy golden stamp right there. So another thing, kind of talk about, because between Kentucky, you know, sorry, should I say Kentucky Spirit and Elmer T. Lee, both of these were some of the first single barrels to actually come to the market.
Well, actually, the first two single barrels on the market was Blanton's.
Right.
And Kentucky Spirit. And then Elmer come out with his single barrel. The first two barrel proofs on the market, when you say barrel proof, no water can be added to it. Whatever comes out of that barrel, you have to show it on the labels. And Booker's from Jim Beam, Booker Dole, And our rare breed was the first two barrel proofs on the market. Now everybody has them, but that was the barrel proofs we come out with late 80s, early 90s. Single barrels come out right after that. Now everybody has them. But that's the growing market in the business these days, is the small batches, single barrels, premium. And Wild Turkey's always been considered a premium bourbon anywhere you go in the world. And we've kept it that way. We haven't changed anything. A lot of distillers say, I go back to the 70s, 80s, a lot of people changed their formula trying to compete with the lighter goods, and they lost out, and I didn't change. Another thing I've seen now, when I started, everything was bottled around 100 proof. You didn't have 90s or 86s or 80s, the lowest you can bottle bourbon and call it bourbon by law. We come under federal government supervision. But people started going down in proof, and now it's a huge trend going back up in proof. Nobody wants low proofs anymore. They want the hundreds, high 90s, hundreds.
We want to taste what you taste. You get right out of the barrel.
And this is what's really, now it's back going back to that. People's wanting the higher, even in the scotches and everything, everybody, they're going back to the higher proofs.
You think that's why Rare Breed has had so much success lately?
Yes.
So now that bourbon's really in the spotlight, you've seen, like, you're not hesitant to take a back seat even at 82 years old, right? No. So, you know, you won't stop to continue to travel and talk about Wild Turkey.
No, as long as I'm set 2 feet on the ground, I'll do it. I'm here 5 days a week, 9-10 hours a day, and I come out every Saturday just over to the visitor center to talk to the visitors, and a lot of times after church on Sundays, I'll come out after church, after lunch, and just say hello to the visitors and all. I consider myself a people person. I'm not any better than anybody else. I'm just one of those.
Well, that's what Eddie kind of told us, that he was pretty nervous the first few times he had to speak in front of some people, and you kind of reinstilled in him that it's not, you'll get used to it, right?
Well, I told Eddie when he first started going out, he can't be me. He's got to be himself. And that's what he's got to be. He's doing a great job for us now. But he can't be me. He's got to be his own self. And he's doing a great job for us now.
So I guess with that, you know, now that Eddie's taken over and he's the kind of doing a lot of the main operations around here, what's it mean to you as a father to be able to sit there and trust him with the business for the next generation?
Well, you know, that's something I'm very proud of is, you know, you're seeing somebody following in your footsteps that's going to keep on the tradition and all. One of the proudest moments in my life, still get a little teary-eyed about it, we have the Bourbon Hall of Fame. And I've been was the original member of the Bourbon Hall of Fame, Booker, Delmer, and some of us were. And this is something that's nominated by the bourbon people, then it goes before election, and you're elected into the Bourbon Hall of Fame. And Eddie was elected in the Bourbon Hall of Fame several years ago, and that's one of the hardest jobs I've ever done. It's easy for me to promote one of y'all into the Bourbon Hall of Fame, inducting you in.
Oh, please do.
But
no, I'm just
but trying to induct,
we got a way to go.
Trying to induct your own son.
Oh yeah,
that's a hard job to do.
So this was a question from one of our listeners from Bourbon Nuga on Twitter, and he says, do you wish that the old distillery was still down by where Warehouse A sits?
Well, if it was, we couldn't be doing the business we're doing now. That distillery was built back in the 1800s, and there was wooden beams and all. We tried to save it, but by all the federal laws and all, now there was no way. It was old wooden beams. It was notched and all. And we had studded up the floors, you know, things like that. But, no, it's the same thing at the new distillery, the same size steel. Everything's the same except one thing, where we had a few fermenters. We had 9 30,000-gallon fermenters and 15 15,000-gallon fermenters. And that, we couldn't build out over the Kentucky River or the main highway. And we had all this land here, and it was just natural for us to go up on the hill where we had plenty of land and build a new, but the steel's the same size, everything. The only thing, biggest change, now we have 24 30,000-gallon fermenters. But everything else is identical to what was at the old distillery.
Okay, so another question from Primo 55, and I'll kind of leave this and try to figure this out, but it says, the eternal debate, the cheesy gold foil 12-year or the split label 12-year?
This is something that has been going on for years. We had three or four different labels of the 12-year-old product. We had the gold and the cheesy gold and the split label. and it was the same product. But people is swears up and down, oh, this was better than the other one. I've heard this all the time, but it was the same product going in it every time.
So what was the best product that you think you've ever tasted coming out of this distillery?
Actually, every day.
Every day? Okay, that makes it easy.
Yeah.
So actually, we've done a few limited editions. One of the top awards and all was American Spirit. It was a 15-year-old bubbler been bottled at 100 proof because we had never bottled anything at 100 proof before. We have a limited edition. Everyone, I got to give you my personal taste. I said 7 to 12 or 13 is my ideal taste for bourbon. A lot of people think the older it is, the better it is. But to me, actually it's over at 13. So that white oak wood becomes a dominant flavor. You use the caramel, the vanilla, the sweetness and all. And the white oak wood becomes a lot of woody, smoky flavors to it. My personal taste, I don't like that. Now, when we do a 14 or 15, the oldest we've ever done was a 15-year-old Master's Keep last a couple of years ago. Now, with that, our storage buildings are 7 stories tall, metal clad, metal roofs, windows. The top floors, it can be 30 degrees in the summertime, difference between the top floor and the bottom floors. The middle floors are ideal for aging. But when we do something older, we find a few extra barrels that we think's aging a little extra special. And we'll set them aside, maybe 100 to 150 barrels. And we'll set them aside, we'll keep tasting them. And if it starts getting that woody taste, we can lower them down in that storage building and slow that aging down. And that's what we do when we do an older product over 13 years old. We can move 100 to 150 barrels around to do that. We can't move 600,000 barrels right. around, no way.
You're going to need a few forklifts to make that happen.
And all you do is roll them by hand. They're rolled in on rigs.
Well, it still seems like a lot of labor involved, yeah, right?
But you wouldn't have enough room to move them around. We got 28 warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do here, we have some ages. You might go in a storage building here. You might find some it's a day old. You might find some up to 12 years old in that same building. We never put 20,000 barrels of 1 year in a building. If we had a fire or a tornado, we can't turn the clock back. If we lost 20,000 barrels in 1 year, that'd be a third of our business for that year when it got aged to sell.
Mm-hmm.
So we put a little of every year in all of our storage buildings. So if we lose something, some tornado, fire, we'd still have enough product to keep going. But if you put it all in one building, something happened.
So kind of talk about, you know, you've always said that sort of the younger, I wouldn't say younger age, but the 6 to 8 year is kind of like your favorite range, right? And Eddie's been experimenting and putting out a lot of things that are, as you said, a lot older, 15, 17 years. So kind of give us your thoughts.
Well, that's your younger generation. You know, your taste buds is just like one of the big things right now. Rye whiskey is huge right now. We're still on allocations on rye whiskey. 6-7 years ago, us and Jim Beam was about the only two making rye whiskeys. We was making 2 or 3 days a year. Say we make 560 barrels a day, but we was only making 2 or 3 days a year of rye whiskey. And the last, from 2009 up until now, rye whiskey's made a huge, huge jump. We're still on allocations on our rye whiskey. We can't get caught up. You know, ours is between 5 and 8 years old, and I think that's the best for rye whiskeys. And we think we're catching up, and the first thing you know, sales keeps going up on it. But that's the biggest jump that I'm seeing now is the rye whiskey category. It's really, really booming right now.
I know there's a few of those bottle chasers out there, and they always say that white whale is finding the old wild turkey rye that said it's come from Maryland.
Yeah, made in Baltimore.
Well, you know what it was? When I started, it's like bourbon. Bourbon is a distinctive product of America. This is the only place you can make bourbon is the United States. When I started, if rye whiskeys didn't say Maryland or Pennsylvania, people didn't think that it's not rye whiskey. Because the first whiskeys made in the States was rye whiskey. The East Coast was dominant rye grain. And they made a lot of rye whiskey in Maryland and Pennsylvania. And people thought, that's the only place could make rye whiskey. And then many years ago, it's all been made in Kentucky for 30 or 40 years now. And then when it got to Kentucky, corn was the dominant grain. And that's where the bourbon come into effect. They started using corn in place of rye. Now, I say we're still heavy in rye content on our bourbon. But corn becoming, it got its name from Bourbon County. Bourbon County Kentucky over here in Paris, Kentucky, is where bourbon got its name from.
There's been so many rumors about how that always happened, yeah. Right? So it's always good to dispel something. So here's another question from the guys over at Breaking Bourbon. They said, if you're going to share a drink with anyone, past, present, or future, who would it be and why?
Oh, gosh, that'd be hard to say. You know, so many people that... say with Booker and Elmer and I, we've had a lot of good times together sitting and sharing a drink with each other. But it's so many people. So many I've enjoyed being with and basically seeing how they enjoy it, sitting and enjoying with them. And, you know, it's so many, many people all over the world that I've enjoyed doing that with.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, yeah.
One of Herb Kelleher. Have you ever heard of Herb Kelleher?
I don't think I have.
He was the owner and starter of Southwest Airlines.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He was a huge Wild Turkey, and he was a lot of fun to be around with, to drinking Wild Turkey.
I always drink Wild Turkey when I'm Southwest.
That's the only bourbon you can get on Southwest. Exactly. He won't put any other bourbon on his planes. He's been a huge Wild Turkey drinker, and he's been a lot of fun to be around with.
Or is that a handshake that was done underneath the table to make sure that happened? So there's another kind of famous quote out there, and they said, I heard somewhere that if there was going to be a Mount Rushmore of bourbon, you would be one of the first faces on it. So
it's a lot of people said that. The governor of the state of Kentucky said that. A lot of people said that.
How does it make you feel? You just feel like you're still just plain old Jimmy?
Plain old Jimmy, to me, yes.
So what are some of those things that you want to leave as a legacy within the side of this industry?
Well, I want to leave a legacy that Wild Turkey's always been a premium bourbon, stayed the same way, traditional way, not changing to meet short-term things, you know, wanting to be traditional, continue on the same way from now on.
And what do you want to see out of the brand that is going to continue throughout those years? Just the same distillation techniques, aging techniques. Do you feel that maybe you need to experiment with some changes or anything like that?
Well, you know, we've always done a little experimenting, but it seems to always go back to the same old style. It's for ourselves, you know, we want the same product day in and day out, and you can make a lot of changes, and when you're making changes, you're gonna change your taste and flavor of your product.
So is there anything that you think that you made a big impact on here at Wild Turkey that people are going to look back, whether it's your grandson becomes a master distiller here or anything, and he says that my grandfather made this change, and it's always going to be something that people are going to look on.
You know, say, I haven't made any changes.
You don't change,
don't
you?
I don't change. I don't change. Stay the same way. And say it's paid off for us back in the 70s and 80s. Most of the bourbons was declining. I can honestly say this, Wild Turkey never did have a decline. We maybe had a very little growth, but it's continued to grow all the time. It's always been a prestige drink for people. I tell a story, people drink when they're happy, they drink when they're sad.
Maybe even more when they're sad.
Yeah. When they have money and they don't have money. Yeah. That's sort of how it works.
Yes.
I did want to ask, you know, with the boom, is there anything about the industry you don't like right now with what's going on with the boom?
The only thing it has me a little concerned about, coming out with so many different flavors. Mm-hmm. You know, vodka, when it first come out, they started all these different flavors. Mm-hmm. And to me, maybe I'm wrong. Say I'm old-fashioned, hard-headed. The vodkas, you have about every 2 years, you had to come out with a new flavor. People, you know... And bourbon is getting hoarded, a lot of different flavors. You got apple flavored bourbons now. You got different ones. I can't say too much about that because I come out with American Honey in 1976, but it's done well for
you
us.
You can say I did it first. Yeah, exactly.
But this is something that maybe I'm getting a little leery about. So many different flavors coming out in bourbon. Is it going to be something like the vodkas where you have to have a different flavor every 2 or 3 years to keep it going?
Well, the way I kind of see it is that even the purists aren't going to really fall into that,
no,
right?
No, they're not.
I think the only way that, you know, you get, as you said, even with American Honey, what you're doing there is you're getting some more inexperienced people to be able to try the product. I guess the easiest way to put it is if you're a crack dealer.
It's like a gateway drug.
Yeah, you give them their first hit, and then after that, they might come back for more.
Yeah, and one of the biggest things for us now in the bourbon business, I think, is the ladies. You know, my age, you went to a bar or a liquor store, you never saw a lady in the bars or liquor store. You go to the bars and liquor stores now, I'd say half of the people at the bars now is ladies. You go to the liquor store, they're doing all the purchasing of the bourbon now. This is some big change that I've seen. The same when I started, bourbon was considered a southern gentleman's drink. They got off of work in the afternoons. They got their cards, their cigars, and their bourbon, went to the back room and played. Now it's become a worldwide drink. Anywhere you go in the world, bourbon is.
Yeah, you're hanging out with women and hipster bartenders now.
Yes, the bartenders, they're the best salespeople you can have. You know, if I walk in and say, give me a bourbon on ice, well, if they got a certain bourbon they like for the first time, have you tried Wild Turkey? You know, they have a big influence on too. If you just walk in and say, give me a bourbon, if they like certain bourbons, they're going to promote it for you. Things about this, people come in, they'll start, well, why you do this? Why you do that? Because that's the right way. I tell them.
You can always say, well, that's just the way it's always been.
It ain't changing.
Yeah. So is that one of the biggest things you think you take pride in, is just the fact that it's always just been consistent? It's always been the same, never veering away from your tried and true self,
tradition. One of the things we didn't even talk about, the barrels. We use a number 4 char barrel. That's the heaviest you can get. Now, when I started, all the timber, the staves were cut out in the woods, and they sit out in the woods in a cob house, you know, air between each stave stack.
Okay.
And we like from 6 to 9 months. Well, nowadays, everybody's looking at the bottom line. To say I've been fortunate here, that everybody's owned us, I hadn't worried about that. They said we want to keep it the same. And nowadays, they're doing a lot of kill drying.
Dry it faster, age it faster.
And now ours are still stipulation on our barrels that they have to sit out in the woods for a minimum of 6 months to air dry. Of course, the rain and different things, you leaching some things out of that wood that you really
you're missing out on the other way.
And ours still has to sit out in the woods for 6 to 9 months. And we've been dealing with that same barrel company for over 40 years.
Independent stave, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then we've been dealing with our corn fellow over Baghdad, Kentucky, for over 40 years. And they know what, we don't use any GMO grains, you know what I'm talking about, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
We don't use any of those. And they know that. And they know if they send it up here, we're going to inspect it. If it's not right, it's coming back to them.
Right. Uh-huh. Do you ever get tired of talking about the same old thing no matter where you go?
I enjoy talking to people, and I say the main thing, I get more out of it than they probably get out of me. I get from the information from them that, you know, if you just hear all the time, you wouldn't get that information.
Right.
Except somebody writing into you and all. But I like to look you in the eye when we're talking backs and forwards and seeing what you think about it and everything like that.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that, you know, we've seen, I've seen like all kinds of different labels that have been from Wild Turkey over the years. You know, you kind of said that it has like a placebo effect because it's always been like the same thing
Same basics. Yes.
Right. So I guess like why do people go crazy over some of the older stuff? I mean, is it, you think it's just real in their head? I mean,
I think so.
So I've got a bottle of 1970, I probably should have brought it with me. I think it's 78, 8-year 101 at the house. Uh-huh. So haven't even opened it yet because I'm saving it. I probably should have brought it and had a drink with you.
That's a bird looking at you. Remember what I said now.
Yeah. Yeah, but start those eyes closing. It's time to.
Start blinking. It's time to quit.
Oh, man. Okay.
I'm one of those weird people. I do think, maybe it is all in my head, that the older stuff tastes better than the newer stuff. But yeah. I guess maybe it's in my head because I have a story built up in my mind. But
he's got an asphyxiation. I think a lot of people do with like the old national distillers and all that sort of stuff from old granddad and stuff back then. And a lot of people go crazy for it.
Yes. But, you know, that's one of the things. One of the top-selling bourbons in the 60s was Old Crow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And when these light goods come out, they changed their formula and all. And now the old crow's sitting on the bottom shelf. And I'll make you a bet. If you go to a liquor store, the people that comes in and buys old crow are my age. Mm-hmm. You don't see young people buying it.
Yeah, I haven't bought old. I couldn't tell you the last time I had. It had to be in college when we were just buying the cheapest stuff we could get. Yeah. Right.
I did try to buy an old crow chess piece set.
Chess piece.
You remember that? Yeah. Fred Minnick said it was one of the best bourbons. Had. So I was trying to hunt one down, but I was. The guy outbidded me. So,
so I guess another question, you know, looking back over here, a lot of the decanters. So you guys were kind of like following or with Beam in the 70s trying to do decanter type of style marketing?
I'm not sure if we won first on that.
Okay.
We come out in 1971.
71, okay.
And the first was eight in the series. For 8 years, it was a series of them. And limited edition. And then after that, we come out with a series of four bottle series, 4 years. And then after that, we come out with the turkey and the wildlife, the turkey and the coyote, the turkey and the fox, the turkey and the different animals. Mm-hmm. And the last time we done it was 1988. Actually, the first one we put out in 1971 sold for about $22, $23 on the shelf. The last ones we put out in the 80s, we was paying $60 and $70 just for the bottle. Mm-hmm. And everybody, Beam got big into them. There was an old Hoffman distillery here in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. They put out more than anybody at one time. They had the, I don't know if you've seen any of them, not. They had the Huntsman's, the Indians. They had all different things. And they put out a lot of different ones. I don't know. When's anybody putting them out now? I don't know if anybody's putting them out now. Just got.
You don't need to anymore.
Yeah, you don't need to anymore.
They're too expensive to.
They put them in boxes, I guess, now, but uh-huh. Yeah, not decanters.
Then we had the rock or crystal decanter we put out. That's the bottle sitting there.
Oh, the Christmas rye or the Christmas bourbon?
No, the Baccarat crystal decanter.
Oh, the crystal decanter. Okay.
And then we had the Wedgwood crystal decanter, which. But now you can't use them. You know what crystal is, don't you?
No, I guess explain it to me. I mean, I know what crystal is, but
what's it made from?
Oh, shit, I couldn't tell you.
Lead.
Oh, gotcha.
And so, actually, our federal government won't let you fill them.
Yeah. Well, there you go now.
Yeah.
So kind of talk about what the day in life is now of Jimmy Russell, right? Now that you've kind of... I don't want to say taking a backseat. You're not taking a backseat.
No, I'm not taking a backseat.
But in regards of like, I mean, how involved are you still with the day-to-day operations of tastings and all that sort of stuff?
Every day. Still do it every day. First thing I do in the mornings, usually when I get here, I taste a new product we just made yesterday.
No, we came just a little too late, didn't we?
Yeah, that's all right.
And, well, we don't want to spend $150 for a new charred oak barrel and put a bad product in it. We want to make sure it meets our standards before we put it in that. We also want to inspect the barrels to make sure that I don't do that, but I do the taste of the new product. And walk around the fermenters. With so many years that I've been in business, I can look at a fermenter and tell you whether there's something wrong or not with it. You know how the patterns and all are on it. And
you can sense it, really.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Look at them. Talk to operators the night shift, if anything happened during the night or anything like that. And then go over to bottling, see how bottling's going on, just going around.
Make your loops.
Make loops.
So how has the success of bourbon and wild turkey affected you by seeing the growth that's happening, whether it's the community or just the distillery in general?
It's a whole world to me. So you're reaching a whole world now with Kentucky bourbons. Anywhere you go in the world, Kentucky's famous for their bourbons, anywhere you go, and that's something that I enjoy seeing.
Where's your favorite place you've ever been?
Besides
Lawrenceburg.
That's a hard question to ask. The two foreign countries that I really enjoy going to, I like all of them, but Japan and Australia, and they're just opposite. Japan is very formal about everything. Australia, it likes to have a lot of fun, but. that's two favorite places, but I enjoy going to Europe and different places. But that's probably, if I'd have to say, Japan and Australia would be my two most favorite places. And they're big on wild turkey bourbon, both of them. Now, people say because they're big on wild turkey, but no, I enjoy the company over there with them.
They say you're a man that doesn't have jet lag. You don't. You shake your secret right now.
Well, when I first started flying, you didn't have flight attendants. You have stewardess. It's all ladies. And one of them told me one time, done a lot of flying, drank plenty of liquid water, get up and walk. If you're on long trips, get up and walk every so often and all. And it really, it's never bothered me. But the main thing for me is, if I'm going to Australia, which is 15 hours ahead of us right now, when I leave L.A., that's where I usually fly out of L.A. to Sydney or places, I put my time on their time right then. I don't even think about this time unless I'm trying to call back home. But a lot of people tries to stay on their own time, and to me, but I go right on the time that wherever I'm going, even going to West Coast. As soon as I leave here, if I'm going to California, I run my watch back 3 hours and get on that time and stay on it. Because what'll happen to you, I know going to Australia, when I first started going over there, I got in there about 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. They wanted you to go to bed and sleep and go out that night. Well, I don't. I stay up. Because if I went to bed that morning and went to sleep, woke up in the afternoon, I go to bed that night, I couldn't sleep. So I stay. Now, sometimes, you know, times that 35, 40 hours you've been up, besides what little sleep on the plane, you're ready to go to bed that night. It's get right on that, wherever you're going, get on that time and stay on it. That's what you need to do. To me, that's what's helped me so much.
Pro tips from Jimmy Russell. Yeah.
That's right, travel trips.
So I guess another question is, you know, regards of when did the travel really start picking up for you? About like how many years ago did your role really change from being behind the scenes to now being in front of everybody and traveling all the time?
25, 30 years ago when they first sent me out to save, I was all marketing salespeople at that time. Now everybody in the bourbon business has somebody out. Now most of them are ambassadors, but us and Eddie, Craig Beam, Fred Noe, they've all started out in production. They've been in the making part of it. A lot of them are ambassadors. It's out doing it now. But this is something... you go out, they'll say, well, he knows what he's talking about. He's actually made it. This is something that impresses me a lot.
Would you enjoy more making it or talking and meeting people?
Both.
Both.
And drinking it.
Then drinking it. Well, yeah, of course.
So I guess on the drinking it part, you know, Booker had a he thing, you know, he was called the Kentucky Chew. So yeah. Kind of talk about your process
tasting. We both all say, I say give him that good old Kentucky, roll it around all over your mouth and get the true flavors and all. The things that I really look for is first is the color. Bourbon is the only product in the world that you cannot add color to. It has to be a natural color. You want a good, rich, deep, amber, bright color to it. But the most important thing to me is the nose, the aroma. And I use simple terms explaining to people. If you want to be technical, I can get there. But if you walk into a restaurant...
Let's get technical. Get technical.
But if you walk into a restaurant, what's the first impression you get of the food?
The smell.
The smell, the aroma. If it doesn't smell good, I don't care how good it tastes, you done it's not any good. Same way in bourbon, you ought to get that... I'm giving the basics, the caramel, the vanilla, the sweetness, the fruity. You ought to get that same aroma. And I like smell with my mouth closed, and then smell again with my mouth open. Get all the flavors. And then put it in your mouth and give it that good old Kentucky chew, get the flavors all over. And then the last thing that I look for is the finish. What kind of taste does it leave in your mouth? Does it leave a good taste? Does it leave a lingering good taste in your mouth? If it leaves a bad taste in your mouth, you probably won't want it anymore.
Probably not. That's pretty typical.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess how often are you... So you say you're tasting here every day. I guess how much are you tasting when you do it?
Actually, we just taste a little bit and get the flavors and all and then spit it out and rinse your mouth out. Because, see, we're... Some days we might.
Is that the hardest part about the job?
Some days, you know, some days we're tasting it from the day it's made all the way up to the day it's bottled. And so some days you might taste 40 or 50 samples. We'll never taste over 5 at a time because they'll set up 5 samples in the lab. You go in and taste them and then go back and do some the other job for 45 minutes, come back and taste 5 more. Because if you sit there and start tasting a lot of them, you're going to kill. You give you it kill your taste buds, and you want to make sure as it's sitting there aging each year, that it's meeting your standards and all.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you taste, do you taste that the, you know, the straight out of the barrel proof, or are you tasting at the finished watered down product?
I like to do it both ways. Most people likes to cut it to 40 proof to do their tasting, but I like to taste it at barrel strength, and also it's cut down with water some. So you're getting a variation there of what the flavors are.
Is there a panel or anything that kind of assists you? Or
five on the panel
five,
here.
Gotcha.
We got a lot of people in training, so if something, first something happened to me, we got somebody ready to step in and take over. And we will not taste together. They set up the samples in the lab for us. I go in and taste and do the scoring of them. Eddie will come in behind me or for me, and he'll do the tasting and score them and turn the paper in. If you're tasting together, you can influence people.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's nothing wrong, if I pick up this bottle of water and something gets my bat in my eye, they're watching you. They think, well, it's something wrong with that. They start looking for things that's not there, so we'll never taste together. Or you could really influence.
I was about to say, did you make that mistake at some point in the past?
No. But you can, if you don't believe that, just try it sometimes when you're out. Boy, I taste, that tastes like raspberries. First thing you know, somebody said, well, yeah, I taste that too. You can influence people.
Placebo effect.
Well, I think if I'm tasting bourbon with Jimmy Russell, I'm just going to.
Yeah, whatever he says goes.
Yeah, it's pretty much the master right there. So I guess we'll kind of wrap this up. Kind of leave us on a note of, you know, when you want people to come and visit the distillery, what do you want them to experience?
I want them to, here at the Wild Turkey Distillery, we want you to experience the complete operation. We want you to see how it's distilled, how it's fermented, how it's aged, how it's bottled, and everything, and then finish off in the visitor center with tasting four of our products. Let you taste. You know, one's not better than another. See which one you know. My taste buds are different from yours. If we all like the same food, it would just be one food out there. You know, everybody has different tastes, different flavors. So what I like to see is people come and do different tastings and do the tasting, see what they really like. Not what I like, what they like. And another thing I like to do a lot of times about the group of people with our marketing salespeople or other people, I like to do a blind tasting. I'll put in different products. And you'd be amazed what'll happen in that. People will taste it and taste this one, taste that and taste that. Well, I love this one. Well, you tell them what it is. There's no such thing. You tell what each one of it. I know that's not right because I love that brand there, and that's not the way it tastes. But in your mind, if you know what you're tasting.
Oh, yeah.
But if you're doing a blind tasting, you'd be surprised what will happen in doing that.
Yeah, blind tastings are a lot of fun.
Yeah, right. So one last question I kind of want to pose to you. You know, we've heard this over and over again in some forums, straight bourbon or whatever, and people say that older turkey is better turkey. You know, whether they get a bottle from the 70s and 80s or crack it open, they think it tastes better than today's. Kind of, what is your thought on that? It's all in your head, right?
Well, the funniest thing about this, you can change a label. And people swear up and down, if you don't taste it. I can tell you a story about this. Many years ago up in Washington, D.C., at a famous bar up there, we changed our labels on our 1.75s, and a lot of the officials was in this bar every night, and they drank, and he bought the 1.75s at the bar, and he had a new label on it. They all, that night, that's not what we've been used to drinking. It don't taste the same. Well, our salesperson, the fella that I knew, they called me and started, I said, it's nothing difference in it. And he said, well, I've got an old bottle. He poured it out of the other bottle back in that old label. That night they take, now that's the right stuff. And then he told me, but you'd be surprised how much effect that has on you in tasting of. You just change something on the label or something other.
Did you have a favorite label through the years?
Well, ours have been basically the same all the time. Only one that had something right over there. For many years, the old turkey, his eyes was looking right at you, where it's sideways now, but the eyes was turning right at you. And my favorite story was to tell people, when those eyes started blinking at you, it was time to quit drinking.
That's pretty good advice.
Well, that's awesome. I think we're going to wrap it up on that note. So, Jimmy, I want to say thank you again
for coming
on the show today and dropping some wisdom and some good jokes. This was a pleasure, and like I said, I think a bucket list item for a lot of our listeners out there.
Well, thank you all for having me. Enjoy it. You're always welcome here at the Wild Turkey Distillery anytime you want to come. All the visitors are always welcome here, and we'll show you everything we do except one thing. We will not tell you our percentage of grain.
But if you time it right, you might catch Jimmy at the gift shop. Yep. And be able to get your bottle signed at the same exact time.
Correct. Yes, I'd be glad to.
Awesome. So again, thank you for being on. If you like what you hear, make sure you support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. Follow us online on all those great Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram handles at Bourbon Pursuit. And I even hear that Jimmy has a Twitter handle nowadays.
Yeah, do you know how to tweet?
He's shaking his head.
What the hell is that? No, thanks again. Oh, go ahead.
I'm on it all the time, but I'm an old school.
That's refreshing sometimes.
Yeah, Eddie will say you'll get an email and you'll say you need to CC my assistant on it or something like that. Yeah. I can read them, but I'm not going to respond to them.
They know. They got my email set up. They know I've read them.
But you ain't responding back. That's pretty smart. Yeah, but thanks again. I really appreciate taking
Thank
the time.
Thank you all for your time. Spending your time to be with us. Really, say you're anytime you're always welcome here if you want to come back.
Absolutely.
We'll take you up on it.
Yeah, right. About Saturday for dinner. Yeah, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So, no, guys, if you have any suggestions, comments, feedback, we'd love to hear it from you, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast of Bourbon Pursuit is in partnership with thewhiskeywash.com, a lifestyle website for news and reviews for people who like whiskey, and for those who think a life without whiskey has no style, thewhiskeywash.com.